Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm so glad you stopped by because today we're going to talk about one of my favorite television shows from all time. Whether you're a big fan of it, have barely heard of it, or never heard of it at all, and I hope you've never heard of this show because it's an important anthology in TV history, I'm glad you're here. So today what I want to talk about are my favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone. So The Twilight Zone was a TV anthology that originally aired from 1959 to 1964 on CBS, ran originally for five seasons. It was revived in the 1980s. And then there's been a new one that just came out, I think, like this past year. And the new one is bad. I can't stand the new one. But the old ones, I think, are really good. So according to Wikipedia, the episodes are in various genres, including fantasy, science fiction, suspense, horror, and psychological thriller, often concluding with a macabre or unexpected twist, and usually with a moral. So here, to get us set for the mood, let us jump right into The Twilight Zone.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension, a dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Okay, so The Twilight Zone began, it was a creation of Rod Serling back in the 50s, and Serling was a big fan as a kid growing up of pulp magazines or pulp fiction. So pulp fiction first began, I believe, in 1896, and it was these short stories, dime novels that were produced on really cheap paper. So like the cheapest paper you could get at a paper mill made out of like the pulp, you know? So, think of pulp as like that, you know, trees that are, you know, all chewed up to make paper. It's not the high quality glossy paper. It's the cheapest stuff you can. And with pulp magazines, you printed it on the cheapest material to get that, you know, to get the highest value out of it. And usually the covers were kind of lurid, adventure stories, science fiction, horror, usually had damsels in distress on the front in varying degrees of dress. So those are the kinds of interesting stories Serling liked as a kid. And as he grew up, he wanted to do the Twilight Zone. So it started with a draft. The very first story began with a pilot episode, a draft. This is before the pilot that became the first episode, Where Is Everybody? This one was about a man who dreams about going back in time to stop Pearl Harbor. Every time he falls asleep, he dreams that he goes back in time and he's trying to stop Pearl Harbor from happening. And he tells his therapist this. And I think at the end of that pilot, the twist is he wakes up and the therapist is gone. And it turns out the therapist had died in Pearl Harbor. So, you know, you get the idea there. So one of the things that, you know, happened in the time of the 1950s you deal with a lot is censorship from government officials, but more what was going on. People were afraid to tell stories that might be controversial or that advertisers wouldn't like. And so there's kind of pre-censorship going on. And there's a great interview online. I'll include it in the description of this episode with Rod Serling and Mike Wallace of CBS back in 1959 before the show debuted. And they're talking about it, and Wallace asks him about this issue about whether he has to censor himself in the episodes that he tells on the Twilight Zone.
Is pre-censorship, though, involved? Are you simply writing easy?
In this particular area, no, because we're dealing with a half-hour show, which cannot probe like a 90, which doesn't use scripts as vehicles of social criticism. These are strictly for entertainment.
These are pot boilers.
Oh, no, I wouldn't call them pot boilers at all. No, these are very adult, I think high quality, half hour, extremely polished films. But because they deal in the areas of fantasy and imagination and science fiction and all of those things, there's no opportunity to cop a plea or chop an axe or anything.
Well, you're not going to be able to.
Well, before I continue, so here Serling's making a good point that The Twilight Zone was able to comment on socially important issues because it did so with stories. It wasn't right on the nose. It wasn't like, here's a story about racism. I mean, there were later episodes that were just straight on about racism or McCarthyism or communist witch hunts or things like that, or nuclear scares. It was because it was told with science fiction and fantasy elements that you had to see the meaning kind of underneath. It's not that hard to find the meaning that's there because it's not patently obvious what they're talking about. They didn't worry about censoring themselves as much. They felt like the stories could just say what they wanted to say through them. But Wallace's follow-up is interesting. I want to play this.
Cop a plea or chop an axe because you're going to be obviously working so hard on the Twilight Zone that in essence, for the time being and for the foreseeable future, you've given up on writing anything important for television, right?
Yeah. Again, this is a semantic thing, important for television. I don't know. If by important you mean I'm not going to try to delve into current social problems dramatically, you're quite right. I'm not.
So I love just like, so you've given up doing anything important for television, right? I want to be like, Wallace, you serious, man? Come on. But it was an untested thing at the time. Like, oh, you're doing your little goofy science fiction stories. You're not going to do important social commentary. And this was important social commentary because we still watch these episodes and we think about our own lives, our own experiences. And because they're told through the lens of science fiction and fantasy, the lessons become timeless. That's one of the great elements of art. Like, what is an element of great art? One element of great art is that it is timeless. It is not stuck in a particular mode of existence, that it exemplifies beauty and truth in such a way that anyone watching it then or watching it 1,000 years later can see the same message. Maybe in a different way, maybe they'll perceive it differently, but they'll still get the same message from it because it's produced in a sort of timeless way. So another thing that I love about, I'll get to that. When it comes to social commentary, one of the episodes that was actually the most protest and controversial was season 4, episode 4, He's Alive, starring Dennis Hopper. You might remember him as the bad guy. He's in the bad guy in Waterworld, the bad guy in Speed. Do not attempt to grow a brain on me. He's great, actually, in Speed, opposite of Keanu Reeves. So great movie. He's Alive stars Dennis Hopper as a young, like, kind of neo-Nazi. And remember, this is taking place like less than 20 years after the end of World War II and the Holocaust. And he's motivated by this shadowy figure, and he actually has an elderly Jewish friend, and he gets sucked more and more into Nazi and anti-Semitic hatred in doing this. Then it's revealed at the end that the shadowy figure motivating him is Hitler, and there's a Hitler in every town, and he's alive in the hearts of those who still hold on to hate. And it actually got like 4,000 protest letters from people who are sympathetic to Nazi ideology. So he was able to touch on these social issues and didn't shy away from that. But on the more lighter end of the things that I appreciate about The Twilight Zone is that, and it's important to know Twilight Zone because it gets parodied and made fun of, and there's references and callbacks to it in current art, movies, and television all the time. And The Simpsons did this all the time. When I was a kid growing up in the early 90s, mid-90s, I always looked forward to the Treehouse of Horror Halloween specials on The Simpsons. Like, every year I was like, 6, 7 years old. And yeah, my parents let me watch Simpsons. Some of you grew up probably in houses where your parents didn't let you watch The Simpsons, but I got to watch it, and it was great. And it was like always kind of spooky and fun. I'm like, oh, it's the Treehouse of Horror episode. And as a kid, I thought these stories were really interesting and cool. And then as I got older, I saw, oh, it's a riff on a Twilight Zone episode. For example, in the season 3, episode 24, To Serve Man, there's a very famous Twilight Zone episode where aliens come to Earth to solve our problems. They're these like giant, well, not giants, they're tall. They're probably 10 feet tall and got these big cranium heads, bald, and they're here to help us. And they want to take human beings back to their planet, which is supposed to be this paradise. And they even have this book that guides them called To Serve Man. And you think like, oh, it's a book for them to help serve us and help us as human beings. But it's actually, as the guy's about to get on the spaceship, she's like, don't get on it. It's a cookbook, To Serve Man as dinner. And they're going to be taken to be eaten along with the other humans that were eaten. So it's an okay episode of Twilight Zone. But I love that The Simpsons makes fun of it in their Treehouse of Horror episode when the aliens take the family back to their home planet, and on the way they feed them this sumptuous meal, and Lisa comes in to give them the bad news.
Don't you see what's happening here? They're fattening us up so they can eat us!
Oh, come on, Lisa.
If you don't believe me, then just look at this book that I found.
Book is right!
Humans, you're...
The book says, by the way, how to cook... It just says how to cook humans.
Stop eating.
Listen, you big, stupid space creature. Nobody, but nobody eats the Simpsons.
I beg your pardon.
Don't play dumb with me. We found your book.
You mean this? It's a harmless cookbook. It's just a little dusty.
So then it goes to how to cook for humans.
Wait a minute.
And then Lisa blows the dust and it's how to cook 40 humans.
Wait, there's still more space dust on here.
Then finally, the final title of the book is how to cook for 40 humans.
Let me get this straight. You thought they thought we were going to eat them. Good God. Is this some kind of joke?
No. They're serious.
Well, why were you trying to make us eat all the time?
Make you eat? We merely provided a sumptuous banquet. And frankly, you people made pigs of yourselves.
I slaved in the kitchen for days for you people, and...
Well, if you wanted to make Serac the Preparer cry, mission accomplished.
You aren't the only beings who have emotions, you know.
So then they get left on Earth and deprived of all the alien good things that they were looking for. So moving on, though. So there's other great ones. Nightmare at 20,000 Feet is a wonderful episode with William Shatner. It's a great episode. Captain Kirk does a great job of acting that he's on a plane. He looks out on the wing and he sees a gremlin tearing up the wing, but no one else can see it. And he thinks he's going mad and he's got to save the plane. The gremlin looks like a guy in a giant teddy bear suit, but it's still a really good episode. Shatner's acting is wonderful in it. And they make fun of it in The Simpsons in an episode called Terror at like 6.5 feet, where Bart sees a monster on the side of the school bus and has to convince everyone. So, all right, now I want to go through just some of my favorite episodes. I'm just quickly go through them. I'm going to try my best not to spoil them unless it's like absolutely necessary, but they're episodes I definitely think you should watch, and I'll play clips of them because I think that they're really fascinating. One of them is season 3, episode 14, Five Characters in Search of an Exit. And it's a really weird existential one where you just have an army soldier, a ballerina, a hobo, a clown, and I think a bagpipe player. And so these five characters are inside of they're at the bottom of a hole. It's like a metal cylindrical hole. And they look up and they see that it's open at the top, but they can't see anything else. And they're just trying to figure out basically just why they're there. So there's a lot of great character moments in this. I'll play a clip.
Where are we? What are we? Who are we?
None of us knows, Major. We don't know who we are. We don't know where we are. Or maybe we're on a spaceship going to another planet. Maybe we're all insane. Or maybe this is a mirage, an illusion.
We're dead. And this is limbo.
We don't really exist. We're dream figures from somebody else's existence.
Or we're each of us having a dream, and everyone else is part of the other person's dream. You call it. You can have it. That's the one thing we have an abundance of. Possibility. Yeah.
So that's everyone who's speaking there. The last guy, the clown, is, I think it's Burgess Meredith, who plays the Penguin on the old 1960s Batman films. And Batman. Actually, that was a terrible Burgess Meredith. I'm off on my impersonations here this week. But he's in several. There's a lot of recurring actors in these Twilight Zone episodes. And Burgess Meredith is one of them. And he is just awesome at it. So I'm not going to give away Five Characters in Search of an Exit. All I will say is all the explanations they propose right there are not the correct ones as to why these five very different people are in a cylindrical tube with an open top. They don't know how they got there. They don't know who they are. They're just trying to figure this out. It reminds me a lot. It has similar dynamics to Sartre's play No Exit, which is about three people in hell. So I love kind of character dynamics like that. And if you haven't seen it, be interesting to see if you can guess the twist before it comes up. So that's Five Characters in Search of an Exit. Another one of my favorite episodes is The Obsolete Man. Another Burgess Meredith one. Actually, he's on, I think, three of these here. He's He's just great. He's great when he goes through these episodes. So The Obsolete Man stars him as Henry Wordsworth, I believe is his name. He's a librarian on trial in a futuristic totalitarian dystopian state. He's a librarian on trial for the crime of being a librarian, and he's considered to be obsolete. And if someone is obsolete, they don't have a purpose anymore, and the state executes them because you have to have a purpose or else there's no reason for you to exist. And he's interrogated by, kind of like by this Grand Inquisitor fellow played by Fritz Weaver, and he does a great job of hamming up the scene too. So that's season 2, episode 29, The Obsolete Man. And let me play that for their interaction between Meredith, who is the librarian, Wordsworth, who is on trial, and Fritz Weaver, who is the kind of the interrogator, the state official, proclaiming him to be obsolete.
You are obsolete, Mr. Wordsworth.
A lie. No man is obsolete.
You have no function, Mr. Wordsworth. You're an anachronism, like a ghost from another time.
I am nothing more than a reminder to you that you cannot destroy truth by burning pages.
You're a bug, Mr. Wordsworth, a crawling insect. An ugly, misformed little creature who has no purpose here, no meaning.
I am a human being.
Delusions, Mr. Wordsworth. Delusions that you inject into your veins with printer's ink. The narcotics that you call literature, poetry, essays of all kind, all of it an opiate. You have nothing but spindly limbs and a dream. And the state has no use for your kind.
I don't care. I tell you, I don't care. I'm a human being. I exist. And if I speak one thought aloud, that thought lives even after I'm shoveled into my grave.
So he's on trial, and eventually he's found guilty. He's considered obsolete, and he's allowed to choose his method of execution. And he has only one stipulation he asks. So Meredith Wordsworth asks his state interrogator to be present at his execution. And so to have him be present there to show up, and it's a mysterious way that he's asked for, Wordsworth asked for an assassin to kill him and to reveal to him alone the method of execution. And he only asks that his that the state investigator, the state representative, be present in the same room with him. So what happens? Well, you're just going to have to go and check that out. The Obsolete Man, season 2, episode 29, a great commentary on totalitarianism, the value of human beings, the dangers of book burning, of saying that, you know, certain ideas cannot be allowed and the state must use its power and coercive force to trample on freedom. Obsolete Man, one of my favorite ones, and great acting in it. Here's the next. So this one's actually one of the scariest ones for me, at least, or at least one of the most unsettling. And that's season 3, episode 8, It's a Good Life. So It's a Good Life is about a town that has been afflicted by a little boy who's essentially a monster. He's this little child has like these godlike abilities. He's probably like 8 or 9 years old. And he can warp reality. He's cut off this town from the rest of the world. And if people are mean to him, or he says if they have bad thoughts, they get sent to the cornfield and no one ever sees them again. So all the adults are really nice to this boy, and they don't do anything to upset him because he has like these godlike powers, or at least these incredible powers. He can change reality. He can make people disappear at will. So everyone's terrified him because the little boy has no empathy or concern for others. He just wants to do things his way. And if people make him mad, he just makes them disappear. So in the episode, It's a Good Life, there is a famous scene where one of the characters, Dan, is there. They're at this party, and the boy makes them play the same song on the piano over and over again. And one of the other townspeople, Dan, has been drinking, and he can't live like this anymore. And he finally lashes out at the little kid, and this is what happens.
Monster, you. You dirty little monster. You murderer. You think about me. Go ahead, Anthony. You think bad thoughts about me. And maybe some man in this room, some man with guts, somebody who's so sick to death of living in this kind of place and willing to take a chance, will sneak up behind you and lay something heavy across your skull and end this once and for all.
You're a bad man. You're a very bad man.
You think that? Go ahead, Anthony. I'm a very bad man. Keep thinking that. Somebody sneak up behind him. Somebody end this now while he's thinking about me. Won't somebody take a lamp or a bottle or something and end this?
You're a bad man. You're a very bad man. And you keep thinking bad thoughts about me.
And so he points to him. And so Anthony, the little kid, points to Danny. You keep thinking bad thoughts about me. And then he turns him into a jack-in-the-box. And so you see just the silhouette of a jack-in-the-box with a human head. And it goes and it sees the guy's head where the toy head should be. And so it's, you see everyone is just so tense. And you can see in their eyes, like, yes, they would like to kill this little kid and end this. But they're terrified that if they fail, what this kid will do to them. A similar kind of dynamic can be seen in a recent film. It's a strange film. It's essentially a comic book superhero horror film called Brightburn. It came out, I think, this past year. And it's basically, what if Superman crashed to Earth, grew up, but when he was a kid, when he was like 12 or 13 years old, he became evil. And so Brightburn is about that. And, you know, there's this idea, like, what do we do with this? You know, it gets to the point, it's pretty violent and gory, actually. I don't recommend it if you have a squeamish stomach. But this idea, like, what do I do? How do I stop this kid if, like, I really can't? Because if I fail, you know, the old proverb, you know, don't wound the devil because there's hell to pay. So, but that one is just so unsettling to me. Just, you know, you got this little boy, Anthony, that he's a scary monster. Someone who has this complete power and no rational thought, no mature rational thought and emotional well-being or empathy for others. So, and it's the kid who plays the little boy Anthony is great. He looks like a little Ron Howard. Maybe he is Ron Howard. I don't know. I'm gonna have to go back and check my credits on that. And this, of course, is also parodied on The Simpsons to wonderful effect. So I'll play just the beginning of this. Is they do the same plot on The Simpsons, but is Bart Simpson who has these ridiculous powers? The episode bit Almighty Bart, part of the Treehouse of Horror, and so they play it and they do the same kind of riffing on it. Let me do that for you now.
Presented for your consideration, Springfield. An average little town with a not-so-average monster. The people of Springfield have to make sure they think happy thoughts and say happy things, because this particular monster can read minds, and if displeased, can turn people into grotesque walking terrors.
Happy thoughts, happy thoughts. Boy, I'm getting mighty sick of this. Ruff, 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 bow, wow.
And did I mention that the monster is a 10-year-old boy? Quite a twist, huh? Bet you didn't see that one coming.
Good morning. Morning.
Good morning, dear.
Hiya, Bart. How's my boy?
Every day, same old cat. I'll make him more interesting. Oh, there. That's better.
Much better. Oh, good. The curtains are on fire.
It's good that you made that awful thing, Bart. It's real good.
So that's what they do in the episode. Whenever the little boy, Anthony, does something horrifying, like, that's good. That's real good that you did that. And so it's a good riff that they do there in Almighty Bart, as a reference to It's a Good Life from The Twilight Zone. Next episode I really like that stuck with me is The Midnight Sun. So The Midnight Sun is an episode about people who are struggling with the fact that the world is coming to an end because its orbit is getting closer and closer to the sun. And so the temperatures keep heating up more and more and more. And it's easily the sweatiest episode of The Twilight Zone, that the people are all there. And, you know, they're just getting hotter and hotter and losing their minds. And one of them paints a painting of a cool, lush waterfall. And her neighbor sees it. And then she starts to go a little batty at the sight of it.
You know, we could swim in that waterfall.
let's do that. Let's swim in it, shall we? I used to do that when I was a little girl. Just sit there and let the water come down over me.
Then she collapses, and just to see in that scene, the audio may not fully convey it what I wanted to, but just to see in their eyes, like, oh, for that coolness, that coldness. Whenever I watch this scene, I'm like, I feel the same way every August in Phoenix. When I visited, I used to live there. You're just like, or people in Phoenix would be like, quit your complaining. It's not that hot outside. But what I like about Midnight Sun is it goes through, and then the episode ends, and you think, that the twist is that it was all just a dream. You think that's the twist, but then another twist smacks you in the face right after that, and it's a great one, because you think, like, oh, it's all just a dream. That's okay. I hate those kinds of twists. They're usually not very satisfying. But then right after that, you get the really good twist to Midnight Sun. You're like, oh, and it just sticks with you. So that's a great one. Got a lot of great acting. One I recommend, season 3, episode 10. Next one up is season 5, episode 6, Living Doll. So this one doesn't have a twist so much. It's also genuinely one of the creepiest ones. I guess, well, maybe it says something about me. The episodes I find creepy are ones that deal with children or dolls that act like children. I don't know. You can psychoanalyze me however you want from that. And it's about this little girl. She's, you know, her mother has married this new guy. Her stepfather is kind of cantankerous, kind of rough around the edges. And she gets this new doll, and he hates the doll. And it turns out the doll hates him because the doll is alive. This is kind of one of the first the doll is alive and evil horror genres or tropes. And so the doll is this little girl doll with pigtails called Talkie Tina. And it, like, talks to him. It talks to the girl all normal, but it starts talking to the stepfather and saying all these really menacing things.
Tina, and I'm beginning to hate you.
And so it's like, wait, what? What's going on here? And so then he sits down with the doll and tries to deal with it and starts telling him more of this other kind of stuff. So,
my name is Eric Strader, and I'm going to get rid of you.
You wouldn't dare.
Oh? Wouldn't I?
Annabelle would hate you. Christy would hate you. And I would hate you.
Just seeing how it works.
So his wife comes in and tries to act normal, and he goes back to talking to the doll.
Oh!
So you have feelings.
Doesn't everything?
Then I can hurt you.
Not really, but I could hurt you.
So it gets more and more like, if you're already unsettled, good, that should be taking you in that direction. And he tries to, like, destroy the doll, and it can't be destroyed. He tries to throw the doll away, and it keeps appearing. And so I don't want to, there's not really a twist to this one. It's just a very unnerving episode and a great episode dealing with horror. I love artists who can scare me, who can do horror or thriller, and they can scare me without resorting to the jump scare. The jump scare is the cheapest scare in horror cinema. Just, you have a loud noise and something pops up on the screen. You're like, ah, like, well, yeah. I mean, the only time where that works, where I'm okay with that, is the false jump scare. They do this in the original Halloween back in the 1970s. So it was, so in that, there's, like, the guy is waiting outside for the killer, Mike Myers, and someone comes up behind him and, like, taps his shoulder. He's like, ah. But they don't do, like, the instrumental, like, ring, you know, they don't do, it's a very light kind of jump scare. I'm okay with that stuff, but not like where the monster or the demon or the ghost or the whatever pops out of the darkness is like, you know, that's, I want him to scare me without resorting to that kind of a scare. Also, this episode, of course, once again, these are all end up being parody. The Simpsons is going on now for like, what, 30 years? And they are starting to run out of stuff to parody and plot lines to do. And so they do this one there for the Halloween special. They're telling different scary stories. And I think Lisa says, I've got a story about a doll. Homer's like, that's not scary. A doll from hell. I'm going to go to the store. And so she tells a story about this. In the story, Homer buys a crust. Well, he gets a crusty doll from like a salesman from like a marketplace. And it's like kind of a seedy, dark, creepy place with forbidden items. And so he picks the crusty doll. And, like, this doll is cursed. You know, don't take it. It's like, I'm sure it'll be fine. It's something for my son. And it's a Krusty the Clown doll, but the doll turns out to be alive, like Talkie Tina. And they riff on that in this episode. So Homer comes home from work, and then the Krusty the Clown doll gets the drop on him.
Yes, who, fat boy?
Marge, look! The doll's trying to kill me, and the toaster's been laughing at me. You, dog water.
I love that. So, help, the doll's trying to kill me, and the toaster's been laughing at me. And so Marge looks on the box, the Krusty the Clown box, and calls the company about it.
Your doll is trying to kill my husband. Yes, I'll hold. Everybody loves a clown, so why don't you?
Yep, here's your problem. Someone set this thing to evil.
I love you, Homer.
Come here, you.
So then it goes on, and then it turns out that Homer ends up like exploiting the doll and turns him to his little like degrading kind of servant. And he's like, how did I end up with this kind of a job? And so Krusty the Clown doll moves in with the Malibu Stacy, their version of Barbie in like the dream house. Like, baby, it's all worth it as long as I have you. And so, by the way, the song that plays on the recording when Marge calls, like, your clown's trying to kill my husband. Your doll's trying to kill my husband. Please hold. Everybody loves a clown, so why don't you? I love that because that's a real song. That's from Gary Lewis and the Playboys back in 1965. So you can look that up. Everybody loves a clown, so why don't you? So that's not one they made up for the show. It's just it fits perfectly for the theme and what they're doing. So Living Doll, that Twilight Zone episode, is a great one. Definitely a creepy one to watch. Finally, here are my last two. So the first one is Time Enough at Last. Season 1, Episode 8. This is, if you ask people to think of the episode of The Twilight Zone they remember, this is going to be the top three. This is one of the most famous ones, and I have no problem spoiling the ending because you should know about this one for just your own cultural edification. So in this one, Burgess Meredith plays Henry Bemis, and he loves reading books, and he works at a bank, and they're like, stop reading books on the job, you can't always be reading books, you know. And he's like, oh, he hates it, like he can't ever get to his precious books. He works at his job at the bank and it's stifling, he doesn't like it. And he reads an article that day about, it says like H-bomb could destroy world, and he goes down into the vault of the bank and hears a giant explosion upstairs, and he comes up and the world's been reduced to rubble because that H-bomb went off. And so he was down in the vault of the bank, protected, and he goes up, and they don't talk about radiation or anything like that. It's just, oh, everyone's gone. He's the last man on Earth. So he wanders around. What does he do with himself? He can find food and grocery stores, but he's like, I'm bored. I'm lonely. What am I supposed to do? And he finds all the books from the library, and he realizes that now he's got time to do it. He can finally read his books in the library, and he bends over to pick up one, and his glasses fall off and break.
That's not fair. That's not fair at all. There was time now. There was all the time I needed. That's not fair. That's not fair.
And so, what's great about this, we don't appreciate this because we're so used to twist endings now. Like, everything's got to have a twist. The movie Frozen has to have a twist. I'm like, why does that guy have to be the bad guy? Why is there a twist villain? Why is there a twist ending? Everything has to have a twist now. And so now we see like, oh, okay, it's a decent enough twist. But back then this was revolutionary, and it ushered in the idea you could tell a story that has this crazy punch at the end that you didn't see coming. And it's just so subtle. You think like, oh, he can finally do this. Like, oh my gosh, what a horrible, ironic twist of fate for him. And it's not overacted. It's just, it's not fair. And you just see the sadness setting in to feel that kind of realism from it. So Time Enough at Last, still a classic one, season one, episode eight. And my favorite one, though, another ending I have to spoil because you need to know it for your own cultural edification. Spoiler alert. I think if it's been more than 40 years, I don't think you have to do a spoiler alert. And that's one of my favorite episodes. The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. And so this is about a small town, that, you know, the residents of Maple Street, and they see a light in the sky and they think that it's aliens. And they think aliens are invading and landing, and that the aliens have hidden themselves among other people. And so a little, like, a boy actually proposes that it was aliens who did it, and like lights stop working and machines turn on and off. And then eventually they all start one-on-one to turn on one another to find the alien who's hiding in their midst. And then it reaches a fever pitch and everything starts, lights are flashing on and off, things are turning on and off, and then you hear them start to break.
It's Don's house!
It's the Wailer's house! Let me get it, I tell ya!
It's Charlie! He's the one!
And so they're all going, they're shooting each other and breaking things. They're like, you're the alien. And then the camera pans away. It zooms away from the town to a hill overlooking the town.
Understand the procedure now?
And you see a spaceship in view sitting on the hill overlooking the town.
Just stop a few of their machines and radios and telephones and lawnmowers. Throw them into darkness for a few hours and then sit back and watch the pattern.
And this pattern is always the same?
With few variations. They pick the most dangerous enemy they can find. And it's themselves. All we need to do is sit back and watch.
And so, of course, that is an allegory for McCarthyism, for the communist witch hunts of the 50s and the 60s, of just witch hunt hysteria, that you lose sense of rational deliberation, you start pointing fingers, and you resort to violence instead of trying to think things through and then fall into panic. So that's a great episode there, that, of course, the monsters that live on Maple Street aren't invading from without. The monsters live on Maple Street and just need enough to rile them into revealing their monstrous, paranoid, hysterical selves. So, well, I hope that gave you a bit of a taste of the Twilight Zone. There's other episodes I didn't get to. If you're a subscriber at trendhornpodcast.com, feel free to leave a comment there at trendhornpodcast.com. Tell me, is there an episode you agree with? Are these some of your favorites? I'm not trying to rank them. These are just ones that I enjoy. If there's one you really enjoy that didn't make it on this list, leave it in the comments. Or if you agree with me on some of these episodes or disagree, feel free to leave a comment there. Thank you guys for stopping by. And I hope you have a very blessed day and a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrendHornPodcast.com.